Welcome to Byline. I'm Rick Howlett. President Obama's health care overhaul will now proceed after the Supreme Court upheld the law yesterday, with Chief Justice Roberts joining with the court's four liberal justices in a 5-4 decision. Implementation of the Affordable Care Act will move forward, with local governments, businesses, health care providers, and advocates for various sectors of the population bracing for its impact. And here to talk about that are Ann Hedreas, healthcare fellow with the Kentucky Equal Justice Center, who joins us by phone, and Terry Brooks, Executive Director of Kentucky Youth Advocates. Welcome to both of you.
Hey,
hi, thank you.
Good to be here.
Kate Miller is going to be joining us shortly from the American Civil Liberties Union to talk about a couple of other decisions on immigration and juvenile justice. Let's start with some numbers. How many uninsured Kentuckians will be able to get coverage now that this thing is going to be moving forward?
We're looking at about 500,000 Kentuckians, and that is if Kentucky goes ahead with the Medicaid expansion, which we strongly encourage them to do. And that would be about 261,000 individuals that would be newly eligible for Medicaid, and another 221,000 Kentuckians that would benefit from the premium tax credit. So these are individuals that would be now having access to health insurance in ways they didn't before. And most important to note is that over 900,000 Kentuckians have pre-existing conditions.
And we're losing our connection with you. We'll see if we can try to restore that, and I'll turn now to Terry Brooks. Terry, good to see you again, by the way.
Hey, it's great to be here always.
We've been talking on the phone for 20 years, so we don't get to see each other in person very much. Well, tell us a little bit about what the impact of this will have on children in Kentucky.
Sure. You know, Rick, there's honest debate and there's political debate about ACA in a lot of sectors. The one arena that it seems like Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives can agree on is that the provisions for kids in ACA are positive. So yesterday was a real win for children. In our analysis of the ACA, certainly some of the more nationally publicized aspects, young people staying on parents' insurance until they're 26, elimination of pre-existing conditions, will positively impact Kentucky kids. There are some in-the-weeds provisions around foster youth, around some preventative care that has Kentucky written all over it. So unlike some other states where, frankly, kids fare better in health status, we think that there's some subtext within ACA that are going to be particularly useful to Kentucky's kids.
Now, there are some prevention elements of this that you really have been looking forward to.
Yeah, there's if you look at the preventative care provisions, there's really two things that jump out at us. First of all, currently, preventative care bears a cost for parents. And what that means in Kentucky is all too frequently a mom or dad has to look at their checkbook and make a decision to wait until that kid gets really sick, take them to the emergency room, and that's how they get their well care checkup. Under this, the pediatric care provisions will pay for, it'll provide those annual checkups. The other piece that for Kentucky is so important, if there's an area of health where Kentucky's kids do especially poorly, it's in oral health. And part of the pediatric comp package that's in ACA provides for both oral and vision coverage. So all of a sudden, Kentucky kids can get those annual let's see how you're doing checkups, and they can get their mouth looked at as part of this package. So again, we think that those aspects will have, frankly, a stronger positive impact in Kentucky than they might in some states where children tend to fare better.
I think Ann Hedreas with the Kentucky Equal Justice Center is back with us. Ann, can you hear us?
Yeah, I can. Can you hear me?
Much better a phone connection. Thank you for enduring this. You talked about some of the numbers. Hundreds of thousands of Kentuckians will be getting coverage. Assuming the Medicaid program is expanded and this health care exchange is created by the state, I mean, what kind of impact do you think it will have on the current Medicaid program, which has been, you know, as you well know, been swimming in red ink?
Well, it will substantially expand it. It'll expand it by about 25% at least. So what that means is we're going to need a lot more providers who are going to be able to serve this population. The good thing is that Kentucky in various ways is already serving this population. So what we have to learn how to do is redirect our resources towards Medicaid and towards serving some of the most vulnerable people in our state.
We are joined now by Jody Mitchell, the executive director of the advocacy group Kentucky Voices for Health, who was running a little late with the traffic. Thanks for joining us, and welcome into the cool weather.
Thank you.
Good to have you here, Jody.
Great to be here with you all.
Let me turn to you with a question. Congressman Yarmuth said yesterday that more people will get behind this law once they learn more about what's in it. Do you think there's quite a bit in there that we still haven't digested or know about?
Exactly. I've had a lot of conversations with community groups and organizations, and they still are unclear of what's in the law. And Kentucky Voices for Health, as you might know, has an issue brief, What Health Reform Means to Kentuckians. And that issue brief is still high in demand 2 years after the signage of the law. And I think now that it's been validated and folks who were unclear, now with the Supreme Court validating the law, more people are going to seek more practical information about what's in it and maybe not rely so much on the political posturing.
Are there any, for lack of a better term, little nuggets in there that we don't know about that you're looking forward to seeing now implemented? We talked about prevention with Terry a few minutes ago, that you're looking forward to seeing implemented as possible, I guess, next year or 2014.
Right. 2014, of course, is the big year. We expect to have 300,000 additional Kentuckians become eligible for Medicaid coverage. And as you know, the Supreme Court made the decision in their announcement yesterday that the federal government cannot penalize states or cannot force states to do the Medicaid expansion. However, there's so much at stake as far as dealing with the uninsured population that we have in Kentucky and federal dollars being on the table, that we believe that's in the best interest for Kentucky to consider that Medicaid expansion.
And Andreas is with us from the Kentucky Equal Justice Center by phone. And are there any elements of the law that that you're concerned about going forward?
I think we've touched on the two of them. One is the decision of the court that the Medicaid expansion is potentially coercive and giving states the option there. We strongly believe that this is in the best interests of Kentuckians and that it is something that we want to go forward. So we are somewhat nervous about Kentucky's choice on that, although we strongly believe that Kentucky will make the right choice in the end. The other has to do with network adequacy and provider availability. Kentucky has areas that are medical deserts, so to speak, where there are very few providers, both primary care and specialists. And as more people start accessing preventative care, which is what we want them to do and what more insurance will allow them to do, that's going to require more doctors and more individuals to be stepping up to see those patients.
Terry Brooks, Kentucky Youth Advocates, any concerns from your neck of the woods?
Well, I'm going to sound like a rerun here, but I think both Ann and Jody made the point that we have to build a case in Frankfort why Kentucky has to accept that Medicaid expansion. I think folks would say that in a state where more than one out of four children live in poverty, where we rank 48th in the nation in economic well-being, to fail to take that option would be a terrible mistake. It's not going to surprise anybody that becomes a volleyball in the toxicity in Frankfort as to where we do it. And reference to the other concern, which is that the best metaphor we have to how the ACA will be implemented in Kentucky is the current managed care system. And, it's that question, how's that going for you? So I think the challenge there is going to be whether the governor and Secretary Haynes learn lessons from what perhaps has not gone as smoothly as they want it. If we're not careful, we're going to be facing an implementation crisis come 2014. The good news is that we have time to think about that. So one of our pitches is that the time to begin to plan that implementation is today, not a year and a half from now.
And Jody, let's get your thoughts on any concerns moving forward now that we know for sure that this, it's been upheld.
Well, I think I share the concerns that Terry just that he just reiterated about our issues right now with Medicare managed care implementation in Kentucky, and given that we're looking at an expansion of those folks, we need to fix the problems that currently exist. Providers need to be getting paid. Network adequacy needs to be addressed, as Ann stated. And we need to look at making sure that access is available. We're very concerned. Kentucky Voices for Health, our priorities are access, prevention, efficiency and effectiveness of the healthcare delivery system, and children's health. And so all of this really plays a part in the future of Kentucky's healthcare. And the county health rankings that came out earlier this year showed where we rank, and that's near the bottom when it comes to health. And so we see this as an opportunity to improve Kentucky's health, and we look forward to working not only with the administration and the legislature, but working with communities, because it really is about you and I. It's about individuals, and it's about the employers, because they are the payers of health care premiums.
Rick, I think another area that at least is an imperative that the state think about is the whole area of awareness. I'll give you one example. One of those nuggets that you referenced that I think is so important to Kentucky is there's probably not a state that has a worse track record of kids aging out of foster care than Kentucky. 3 out of 4 foster care kids who age out wind up homeless or in prison. When you talk to those kids, health care is a real issue. This allows foster care kids who age out to continue to receive Medicaid support until age 25. Our question is, how do we reach those kids? All the provisions in the world can be on the table. If they're not taken advantage of, they do nobody any good. So I think that one of the challenges is going to be what I would call niched outreach, what that foster care kid needs for access versus a senior citizen in eastern Kentucky is going to take very different artistry from the cabinet. And I think that that's going to be a real challenge as well.
There seemed to be some surprise yesterday with the ruling that especially with the upholding of the individual mandate. And you guys have been following this since its conception. And Jody, what were your thoughts yesterday when you heard the ruling come down?
Well, it was interesting because, as the public knows now, you know, CNN reported early on erroneously that it had been struck down, and then it was back up. And I think that confusion was just in the reading of the ruling and the different provisions. They were first looking at the Commerce Clause, and then they were looking at the Tax Clause. And so we were very proud of the decision that was made by the Supreme Court. The controversial mandate will address the adverse health and financial consequences of the large uninsured population. And in Kentucky, we have over 650,000 uninsured. So we want to make sure that the provisions which seek to provide opportunity for individuals to get covered, we need to educate why coverage is important, why it's of value, and we need greater data transparency out there for purchasers of their care.
All right, we're up on a break, unfortunately. Thanks for your time. Thanks for joining us, Jody Mitchell, Terry Brooks, and Ann Hedreas. And Terry's going to be rejoining us for some discussion of another case. Thank you all for joining us. We'll be back in a moment. This is Byline on WFPL.
Thank you so much.
Welcome back to Byline on WFPL. I'm Rick Hallett, and we're discussing some of the major Supreme Court decisions that came down this week in Washington. We've been discussing, the health care ruling from yesterday. And now we're going to turn our attention to juvenile justice, a key decision earlier this week from the High Court, which struck down a life without parole as a sentence for juvenile offenders. And here to talk about that is Terry Brooks from Kentucky Youth Advocates and Kate Miller from the Kentucky ACLU. Kate, welcome to the program. Glad to have you
thanks
here.
Thanks for having
thanks
me.
For standing by with us. Let's get a little background. Terry, first of all, on what case did the justices rule?
Well, this was the case where the decision at hand was whether you could mandate a lifelong sentence. It came from Alabama, Miller v. Alabama, and so that's that was the genesis of the case.
Just to give you some background, the case followed two young boys. They were 14 years old, and they had both been convicted of murder. Just to put it in some perspective, one of the young men, 14 years old, had been in and out of foster care. He had suffered abuse. His mother was abusing drugs, and he had attempted to commit suicide, you know, I think 4 times, the first one at age 6. So this individual was eventually charged as an adult and faced a lifetime prison sentence.
Do you have a handle on how many juveniles are now serving life sentences in Kentucky without the possibility of parole?
I don't have a good hand on it. I know the number is, I think, relatively small, so it shouldn't directly impact a lot of juveniles in the state. But it does have other implications for juvenile justice more broadly. I think when we're talking about sentencing, thinking about the fact that youth are young, they're more likely to be impulsive, they're less likely to be able to get out of a negative environment, and they have a greater opportunity for reform.
Are there statewide trends in juvenile sentencing? How does Kentucky compare to other states in terms of severity of sentences?
I think one of the things that concerns us, Rick, is certainly the Miller, Alabama case. Is you're talking about egregious violent crimes, and that's at one end of the spectrum. What concerns us is, in a lot of ways, equally is the other end of the spectrum. Only one state in the country locks up more status offenders than Kentucky. And again, just a reminder that status offenses are age-related. They're things like skipping school, running away from home. And what we know right now is that, again, Kentucky, Washington, and Texas locks up 60% of the status offenders in America. The current way that Kentucky does it is the most expensive and the least effective way. We could put the young people who are in detention, they could stay at 21C less expensively than they stay in detention facilities. And what we know happens is that those young people who are locked up for skipping school, that pipeline to more serious offenses is very real. The way that kids transition from that status offense to a criminal offense is that interaction with the justice system. We do have some hope, and Kate's certainly involved in this as well. We do have some hope that that's the one area that Republicans in the Senate and Democrats in the State House seem to agree on, is that we need fundamental reform in the juvenile justice system. So we actually see that as a sliver of hope going into 2013.
How would this affect young people who are currently serving life sentences without parole? Would it be a possibility of parole after X amount of time, or how will that work?
I'm not sure how it will impact individuals who are serving that sentence currently. I think we'll have to wait and see.
The opinion found that mandatory life sentences for juvenile murderers violates cruel and unusual punishment, that clause of the Constitution. Do you have any idea what the dissenting opinion's reasoning was in this?
I'm not sure what the dissenting opinions said. I think one thing that's really important to note here, and actually if you have a lot of questions, we're bringing the lawyer who argued this case in the fall for our annual dinner at the ACLU. But I think what this really, the most important thing to take from this is that children are different than adults, and a severe sentence for an adult can be more severe for a child, for example, life imprisonment. So I think that it's really, you know, it started with we can no longer sentence children to die. We can no longer have these mandatory sentences of life in prison without possibility of parole. So I think we're looking at the fact that children are different than adults when it comes to criminal justice, and we have to reflect that in our policies.
There's just nothing more important, Rick, than what Kate just said, which is that anybody who's a mom or dad or grandma or grandpa knows that juvenile brain just doesn't operate the way adult brains operate. And I know that that's hard for some folks to get their head around, but when kids make mistakes, when they commit acts that none of us support, what was going on between their ears is a very different matter than what might be going on between an adult's ear. And I think that's the real core finding of the court, is that kids developmentally have to be treated differently.
Now, there was another big case this week involving immigration out of Arizona. The center point being that Arizona police can still ask residents about their immigration status when they're pulled over or arrested. What's been the ACLU position on this, Kate?
Well, I think it's important to note that the majority of the law was completely thrown out as unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. And I don't think, because Section 2B, the show me your papers provision, wasn't thrown out, doesn't at all mean that the Supreme Court endorsed it. They were really clear in saying right now it would be premature to throw it out under the preemption clause. So something that we can look forward to is that the ACLU filed suit in 2010 with other community groups to look at the Fourth Amendment and the Equal Protection Clause concerns, which is basically you know, when we stop these people to determine their immigration status, how long can we hold them before we have to let them go? And on top of that, how on earth are we going to identify whether or not someone is here illegally without relying on, you know, race, color, ethnicity? And Arizona said, we're not going to rely on that. And I think the Supreme Court's saying we have to give them the benefit of the doubt, but we're not done yet. We're definitely not done.
What's your take on this?
I think one of the stronger implications for Kentucky, Rick, is that it was a very strong decision. There is no question reading the decision that the court said that immigration policy was a federal issue, not a state issue. I think that it will deter. I hope it will deter what we've seen previously, which is sort of this scrapbook of ideas that get promoted in the General Assembly. They don't go anywhere, but they're essentially anti-immigration pieces of legislation. If you're a state legislator, you should have heard really strongly from the court that this is Washington's business, not Frankfurt's business. So I hope we get some relief from that pressure. I think the other thing that it should encourage us to do is to see if the laws that are currently on the books are being implemented. We hear stories, and I'm sure Kate does all the time, about some basic provisions like language access for immigrant families at mm-hmm. schools and in hospitals that isn't being implemented. So it maybe is a reminder that we better look at what we should be doing rather than worrying about new things to do.
Some major heavy decisions in the recent days from the U.S. Supreme Court. Thanks to Terry Brooks of Kentucky Youth Advocates and Kate Miller of the ACLU of Kentucky for shedding some light on
these
issues.
Hey, thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us, and have a good weekend. We're going to turn our attention now on byline to Washington, D.C., where the Courier-Journal's D.C. correspondent, James Carroll, has been watching the dust settle from yesterday's health care ruling and other major developments in the nation's capital. Welcome back, Jim.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Well, where were you yesterday when the ruling came down? Where from what vantage point did you cover it?
Well, I was poised, this modern age, poised at the computer, basically trying to gather comments and reaction as fast as we could get it once the decision came down.
It's hard for me, at least, to believe that in this age of communication that the court was able to keep the decision a secret.
Isn't that amazing? I actually tweeted that yesterday. I said it looked like the Supreme Court is the only branch of the federal government that seems to be able to plug leaks and prevent leaks. It is truly amazing.
It's unbelievable. Well, of course.
I was made on a SCOTUS blog or somewhere else. Somebody said that before the decision was released, about 70 people knew what it said. So those are 70 incredibly discreet individuals for sure.
Wow. Sworn to secrecy. Well, political reaction predictably came along party lines. Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky raised some hackles when he basically said, well, I don't care what the justices say, this law is still unconstitutional, even though several say it is.
Yeah, I think the takeaway is that, those who did not like the health care law before the decision yesterday still don't like the health care law, and those who did like the health care law before the court ruled yesterday, they still like it. The difference being now that you have Justice Roberts, who was an appointee, a Republican appointee, siding with the more liberal branch of the court, in basically upholding one of the central features of the health care law, which was the requirement that everybody be covered by health care. But this is not deterring, of course, people like Senator Mitch McConnell, the Senate Minority Leader from Kentucky, and others who are all still pledging to try to kill it, either in pieces or in toto, in some manner, if they can. The difficulty with that, of course, is McConnell doesn't have full control of the Senate. The Democrats control the Senate, and Barack Obama is still in the White House for now. So they're going to have to elect Mitt Romney president. They're going to have a Republican control of the Senate. They do have Republican control of the House, but that's a few steps too far right now to predict how that's going to come out, of course.
Well, what impact do you see this having on the presidential election going forward? The campaign, I should say.
It's difficult to say because this has been already a prominent issue in the campaign. And as I just said, those who are inclined to dislike this signature program that Obama and the congressional Democrats passed, they're still going to hate it. And they're still going to vote. Many people are going to vote against Obama just for that. But on the other hand, I think you see a lot of analysis that the bottom line beyond healthcare is really the economy. And, you know, where's the economy going to be in November? And that'll probably be the most dominant issue. Now, there may be ways you can wrap elements of the healthcare argument into the economic concerns that people have. I know, you know, Senator McConnell has already sort of shifted gears a bit and talks about how the court, you know, confirmed what he always thought, which is that requiring people to carry health insurance, and if those who do not carry it are penalized, then it's a tax. So they're going to push that very hard. The Democrats, of course, are feeling pretty good that it looked kind of dim for them for a while. I think a lot of people, even some Democrats, probably secretly tell you they were worried about whether this the requirement to carry health insurance would survive the court's review, but it did. So they have the constitutional argument on their side, but it's the merits, you know, basically, and how politicians are going to phrase it between now and November that will really determine how long this law survives politically and how much of it survives.
We're going to be talking with, on another topic, Mary Beth Schneider of the Indianapolis Star about this shortly. But what's been the reaction, as far as you've seen it, in Washington to Governor Mitch Daniels accepting the presidency at Purdue University? It looked like he would end up in Washington in some capacity.
Well, you know, I guess some people just won't believe a politician when he says, you know, I've made a decision and I'm going to stay out. And, you know, Daniels made that decision not to run for president. He, you know, he kind of was courteous about being considered for vice president. But it was very clear that that wasn't his preference at this time in his life. And I think in Washington, people for now have said, well, okay, I guess Daniels is not going to be on the national scene. Now, I should remind you that we've had presidents before who were presidents of universities. You know, Garfield, Woodrow Wilson, and Eisenhower. You know, it doesn't shut down the door all the way, but I'm sure Mitch Daniels would hope that all the chitter-chatter would stop for a while.
Yeah, it looked like to some he would end up in Washington, but I guess if Romney won the election, some sort of cabinet position or in some other capacity, you know, even if Obama wins the election. But he's going to Purdue.
Well, going to Purdue, and, you know, that's a major job, and I can't say that he, you know, I don't know the particulars of what he told them or promised them, but I assume, you know, that's a major commitment, and you're committed to the university at least for some time period. And so I would be very surprised if he jumped out of Purdue and went to Washington into a Romney cabinet right away. I don't see that happening, but I could be wrong. We're always wrong. So that's our motto, always wrong.
That's right. Back to the election for a moment. As far as what kind of role will Kentucky play in the election? Didn't pay much attention to it last time, especially Mr. Obama. But what are we looking at between now and November for Kentucky?
Well, the state is pretty much considered a lock in the Electoral College for Republicans. So other than fundraising visits that might be put together somewhere for Romney or for Obama, I don't think you're going to see a lot of campaign rallies. I know everybody thinks we've already spent plenty of time on the campaign, and there's plenty more, you know, it's ad nauseum, it's never going to end. But, you know, after the summer is over, the amount of time left to campaign in the swing states is going to be very compressed. And both Obama and Romney are going to concentrate on the swing states. And, you know, very frankly, Kentucky is not a swing state. It increasingly looks like Indiana may not be a swing state either, although that's still depending on the experts. Some will say that, well, it depends. But right now I'd say that the feeling is that neither Kentucky nor Indiana are really looking to be the key focus of either campaign in the fall.
James Carroll is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Courier-Journal. I forgot to ask you, James, we're pushing 100 degrees here again today. What's it like in D.C.?
About the same. I understand. I must confess, I've changed station, and I am actually up in New England where it is much cooler, but I don't think I should tell you how cooler.
No.
That's not very nice.
Well, we don't want to hear it. Well, thanks for joining us on your day off, and enjoy your time in New England.
Thanks very much, Rick.
Take care. James Carroll with the Courier-Journal. You're listening to Byline on WFPL. We're going to turn now to the aforementioned Mary Beth Schneider from the Indianapolis Star. Mary Beth, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Haven't had John for a while. Good to hear from you again.
Well, I appreciate it. It's been a lot going on.
Oh, I know. Let's start. We were talking with Jim Carroll. You may have heard about Governor Mitch Daniels accepting the presidency at Purdue, of course, when his term is up as governor in January. That came as quite a surprise to some folks.
Yeah, it had been rumored about for a while, but a couple things seemed to argue against it. One was that the timing, you know, you would think would not work out. But so they made him president-elect and have an interim with somebody else filling in until he finishes his term. And then this whole idea of Mitch Daniels not being involved in partisan politics. When he said that, I tweeted out, holy moly, because I've been covering politics for a long time, and Mitch Daniels has been a part of that all this time. Even when he was at Eli Lilly, he was still somebody who would frequently comment on politics, be involved in political events. The thought of the Indiana Republican landscape without Mitch Daniels as a active player is hard to get used to, and I think it's hard for him to get used to, too, because even though he said he's not going to make partisan statements, he could not resist yesterday when he put out a statement about the health care decision talking about repeal.
That's going to be kind of hard to avoid over the next
It's got to be very hard to avoid, yeah.
Now, under law, will he be able to lobby the legislature when he takes office at Purdue?
Actually, yeah, there's a lot of disinformation about this. There is this one-year cooling-off period that when you leave the administration, you aren't supposed to lobby. But that applies to lobbying the executive branch. It does not apply to lobbying the legislative branch. And in addition, when I actually went back and read the law, there are some exceptions for higher education, too, and a couple other areas. So I don't think that's going to be an issue. And it will, however, be pretty interesting. I mean, he did call for tightening belts, cut budgets, you know, to control the budget. And when he's a president of a university, you do wonder if sometimes he might have a different viewpoint.
Now, I watched his introduction at Purdue the other day. Glowing remarks by members of the Board of Trustees, the vote to hire him.
Might be the
yeah, really. Unanimous vote. But there have been some concerns have been raised elsewhere about his qualifications for the job, being a government person versus an academic person.
Yeah, you know, though, I understand those, but the job, he's not teaching classes.
Yeah.
And he will be a figurehead, a spokesman, a money raiser, a direction setter. I think he'd be hard-pressed to really say that being a governor doesn't fit you for those roles. That's without saying whether he's still the best choice, but that's not at issue. The whether is he qualified? And, yeah, he's qualified. Now, clearly, though, some people are very unhappy about this. There was a dean up there had told the Lafayette paper yesterday that she'd been going to give $1 million, and now she's not. I'm amazed a dean has $1 million to give.
Exactly.
But nonetheless, they aren't going to get it because she's so upset about the choice of Daniels.
Of course, he's leaving in January, and the race is on for to replace him, Republican Mike Pence, Democrat John Gregg. And is the guy from Survivor still in the race?
Yes, he is, Rupert Bonham.
Yeah, Libertarian candidate.
Yep.
So how are we looking in that race? Has there been any polling as to who's got the edge?
No, not that I'm aware of any polling, but I think that even the Democrats would say that Mike Pence would be considered the favorite at this point. Now, it's June, and I do caution people. I don't like to make predictions about political races in June, but it definitely is the Republicans have an advantage. Mike Pence is very well-known. He's extremely well-funded. The Democrats are trying hard. I think of the two convention speeches that they gave, John Gregg actually gave the better speech. But you don't win much by having a great speech in front of your own party. So John's going to have to really get out there and make his case.
Now, it's been this kind of broke earlier in the year, I guess. So a couple of major accounting errors or computer glitches, and this involves some like $500 million total in tax money. An investigation is being launched into these?
Yes. The first error was announced back with a lot of ha-ha-ha back in December, like this was really funny that they discovered that there was corporate e-money sitting around unaccounted for. And that was around $300,000 plus that had been accumulating. And when it finally started accumulating in large sums, it got noticed. And the estate acted then like, what a great thing. We now have money. Well, Democrats acted as if this was the worst thing ever, because this all was accumulating at a time when budgets were being cut, including to schools. Now, schools, the administration would say, well, even if we'd known about this, we still would have had to make those cuts because the bottom was falling out on revenue. Still, the Democrats said at the time that there needed to be an investigation. Republicans blew them off. And then, lo and behold, it turns out there was another big error where counties were shortchanged, and counties have been really hurting for revenue, particularly since not only the recession but the property tax caps. And so this money was going staying in the state coffers when it should have been going to the counties. At that point, the state said, we will have an independent audit. So now that's taking place, and we'll find out what happens later this year. First, they're looking at the auditing group, I think it was Deloitte, is looking at what are the systems in place, what are the problems, and then they'll look at how those things worked.
All right. We're out of time, Mary Beth. Unfortunately, Mary Beth Schneider with the Indianapolis Star. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
We'll be back with more in a moment. This is Byline on WFPL. Welcome back to Byline on WFPL. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, this is our arts segment on Byline, and Aaron Keene has braved the heat and has made it into the studio to talk about arts and arts events this week, and we're going to focus on poetry today.
Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot, Rick.
You bet.
I'm here with Lindsay Alexander, who's the poetry editor of Typecast Publishing, which is a boutique publishing house here in Louisville. And they started in 2006 with one literary journal and have since kind of blossomed into a bit of a grassroots mini media empire, would you say? So welcome, Lindsay.
Hi. Glad to be here.
Last night, you guys kicked off your summer reading series, the Natural Habitat reading series, and one of the poets who read is Morris Manning, and we're going to hear a little bit of a clip from him. Morris was born and raised in Kentucky. He lives on a farm here in Washington County and writes almost exclusively about Kentucky, and is also one of our most acclaimed and best-known contemporary poets. He is a Guggenheim Fellow, and his last book, The Common Man, was a finalist for the 2011 Pulitzer Prize. So you want to hear a clip from Morris's reading last night.
This is called Evangelism. Coming down one hill, I look across the stream and see, bending like a gray-green snake in the hill ahead, a tunnel in the green, a passage studded by the branches, though without proportion, and softly, one by one, they have consented not to converge, but to leave an opening. When I first saw it, I said, it's like a church turned on its side, and the steeple is pointing not to heaven, but only a little farther up the hill, or to some unknown location around the green bend in the wooded air. And besides, the steeple isn't straight. I said this in my mind and marked that if this was a country church, I had, for only a mystical reason, silently answered the altar call, and I was standing at the front with only the green as a preacher to pray and be grateful I hadn't waited longer. I understood the urgency of coming forth in the greenish light. And yes, I felt the presence, or felt a desire to feel it, which I hear is half the way to the presence itself. Or perhaps I felt the presence should be, in simple terms, possible, given the green, which is like a book, inscrutable and slow and not encumbered with the passage of time. I'm certain for a moment I saw in the glow of the green cloud formed as a singular form, though like the forms of all creation, intended to go in and out of revelation, constantly inconstant. I saw the aftermath of a kind of sad joy. I wasn't sure if it was happening or if a moment before I looked, it had happened. But I waited and wanted to see it again. Thank you.
Well, it's not every day that you get to hear a Guggenheim fellow read at Quills near U of L. So Morris isn't a typecast author, though you guys do publish books of poetry. So tell me a little bit about how this reading series started and how it fits into the mission and the business model of your press.
Sure. Well, this summer we've actually kicked off what we call our Typecast Inspiration Institute, which has readings, activities, workshops. We're offering some classes here in the next few weeks to benefit the community that supported us from our fruition. And though running any small business is an exhaustive venture, it's also very exhilarating. And so we thought, why not join the people we love that support us with the joy of art and the joy of place? So all of our readings, all of our activities try to combine those two things. Obviously, Morris Manning is an excellent poet, and if he wants to be a typecast author, he can give me a ring. He combines those two things better than almost anyone, as does our poet, Chris Mattingly, who read it last night as well.
Yeah, and when I think about typecast books, for those of you who haven't seen them yet, you can check them out. Carmichael stocks a lot of the works, and think about how they started with The Lumberyard, a poetry journal that also is designed by Firecracker Press, a boutique letter press in St. Louis, and how integral the physical object is to the typecast product, and how sort of grassroots that feels. We just heard Morris say, like a book, inscrutable and slow. I think about the letterpress movement. Is that sort of in this day of the Kindle and the ebook, is holding a heavy paper letterpressed object sort of analogous to the MP3 versus vinyl?
I think that that's probably a pretty good comparison. At Typecast, I think I can safely say we're not afraid of the digital revolution. We all love books. I love books. I won't get rid of my books, but I do have a Kindle. There are some things that I don't need people to know that I'm reading, and that I don't want to go to Carmichael's and let anyone who reads know that I'm reading because they're bad. I have my beach reads like everybody else. But if something is going to be printed, I think it needs to have a reason now, because printing is more expensive. It does take longer to get to its audience. It needs to have a reason to be printed. So the book object needs to become a piece of art that holds the words as art, but you can look at it and see that it's beautiful as well.
And so you guys have added an online journal also. So we have The Lumberyard, which is heavy, thick paper and beautiful, both vintage and contemporary at the same time, letterpress design. And then there's Sawmill, that is online and featured graphic artists and comics also. So how do you discern then what's a digital product and what's a physical product?
Sure. A lot of times, like The Lumberyard, Sawmill sort of allows us to play a lot more because digital is cheaper. So if we're working with writers or visual artists who we think we might want to involve later, work with for a longer time, a lot of times Sawmill is sort of the springboard for that. So if you follow the metaphor, like a sawmill is the first place that building materials go before they get to a lumberyard, Sawmill we see now as sort of the future of typecast. Not that we'll be all online, but that's sort of our area to play and experiment.
Cool. One thing that's really impressed me is the diversity of voices that are already coming out of Typecast as a publishing house. You guys published your first book in 2010, I believe. Matthew Lippman's Monkey Bars was a collection of poems. And, so far what's come out recently, Jamie Ridenour's British estate mystery, murder mystery weekend werewolf story, Barking Mad.
Yeah.
And then a collection of poems by Matt Hart, who is a veteran of the indie punk scene of the 90s. So what makes a typecast author? What are you guys drawn to aesthetically?
I think aesthetically, we're drawn to confident writers, people who aren't afraid of their roots. Matt Hart's roots are in punk rock, and you're gonna know it when you read his book. Matt Lippman is a dad; he's from Boston. You're gonna know that when you read his book. Chris Mattingly and Amanda Smeltz, who are both upcoming authors, are also very place and personality driven writers, voice driven writers. So I think, although that's sort of an intangible quality, writing with confidence is always attractive to most editors. I think that's not necessarily exclusive to us, but we are particularly maybe attracted to a bit more grit than the average.
Grit. That is an intangible. How do you? Yeah. Another thing that I notice in the typecast catalog and the aesthetic is this interesting confluence of the urban and the rural. In tone, in presentation, just in sort of the difference between like Matthew Lippman, who has a very sort of urban outlook and experience, versus someone like Chris Mattingly, whose book is coming up later this year, who's very rooted in small town Kentucky also. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. We actually had, that was, I think, part of what got our minds jogging around the Typecast Inspiration Institute this summer was that sense of place. And now that we're developing sort of more of a body of work for ourselves, looking and seeing, like, what is it that we're attracted to? And it does seem to be this intersection of urban and rural. Even if the lumberyard had no poems in it, just the aesthetic of that rough paper with, like, really urban illustration seems to be driven by that opposites attract situation that we're looking for.
Well, so let's talk about the Inspiration Institute. You guys are going to be featuring some workshops where folks from the public can come. And what is it that they're going to be doing there?
Sure. Well, events will change and rotate as time goes on. But right now we're offering two workshops. One is a natural habitat creative writing workshop. And that one I'm really excited about. We're going to be going to the Falls of the Ohio State Park and sort of using the natural history and the outdoors there to get inspired. We'll have structured creative writing prompts. We'll talk about publishing, that sort of thing. But mostly, we'll have structured time to explore the grounds. And speaking of urban and rural, it is a really interesting place for that because on one side, you're on some of the oldest exposed fossil beds, almost 400 million years old in the world. On the other side, there's a junkyard and you can see it. And while that's not beautiful to everyone, it's sort of beautiful to us. The workshop will include one of our backlisted books, Oil and Water, which the proceeds of that book go to help the Gulf and still cleaning up after the BP oil spill. So that's great. And then our other one that we're offering this summer is called Grave Matters. It'll meet in Cave Hill and we'll be using the time to talk about buried people and cultures and sort of remembering those and reimagining them. So again, we'll have writing prompts, a backlist title. We'll bring cold drinks and journals for everyone. And at the end, we'll talk about publishing, how to submit, what editors are looking for, that sort of thing.
Awesome. So you're really sort of creating a bit of a writing community then around your press. Is that something that a lot of small presses are doing now, or is this kind of a unique effort?
I don't know. I hope that they're doing it. I felt like when we came up with this idea, we all thought, Wesley Fairman is another editor and Jen Woods runs the press. We all thought, why didn't we think of this sooner? Because again, we really appreciate getting to be in Kentucky and work with the people we get to work with and see the friendly faces at our events. So this seemed like the natural progression of what it is that we're working on.
Yeah. Excellent. Okay. So, and folks can find out more information about this
On our Facebook, Typecast Publishing, or at typecastpublishing.com.
Awesome. Awesome. Great. And so, Lindsay, you are the poetry editor of The Lumberyard.
Yes.
And of the press as well.
Yes.
Yes. And the next title coming up from Typecast Publishing is?
Matt Siegel's This Is What They Say. He's from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan.
Ooh.
So everyone that I've talked to from Michigan that is not from the UP is scared of the people from the UP because they're so serious business. it's just a very remote place, but that book is really wonderful because talking about remembering and reimagining buried cultures, that's definitely a place, more rural factory life, that we forget about. And now people are sort of trying to remember.
I don't have to interrupt you, Lindsay. We are out of time. Lindsay Alexander from Typecast Publishing and Aaron Keene.